This is Free Speech Radio News for September 22nd. I'm Matt Martin. Coming up, over 100 activists on the way to the IMF World Bank meetings in Prague detained as troublemakers. On the eve of national elections in Yugoslavia, the opposition makes plans to privatize the economy, the politics of hemp and Indian sovereignty. And the nation's leading progressive radio network faces suits from listeners and its board members. The first federal elections in Yugoslavia since NATO's bombing are coming down to the wire. On Sunday, voters will head to the polls to decide whether to oust President Slobodan Milosevic and replace him with Vojislav Koštunica. The opposition vows that if they unseat Milosevic, they will immediately begin integrating Yugoslavia into the rest of Europe. So while protesters in Prague prepare for the meetings of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, the Serbian opposition has been working with those same international lending agencies. From Belgrade, correspondent Jeremy Scahill looks at the economic plan of the Democratic Opposition of Serbia.
The last public rally of the Democratic Opposition of Serbia before Sunday's elections lasted just over an hour. More than 150,000 people packed the streets of the capital city, singing this song, which has become the anthem of the opposition, Save Serbia from Asylum Koštunica. Many times throughout the night, the crowd chanted, he's finished, referring to Slobodan Milosevic.
Democratska pozicija Srbije, Vojislav Koštunica.
Vojislav Koštunica wove his way through the crowd, shaking hands and greeting his supporters, before taking to the stage for what many here say was one of the biggest nights of his political career.
Ja sam vaš deo, običan sam čovjek kao I svi. Nije mi
nada. I'm part of you, he said. I'm an ordinary man like all of you. It's not my intention to rearrange the world. My intention is that together with you, we will rearrange our country.
Znam da vi želite da živite isto kao što ja želim da živim.
I know that you want, as much as I do, to live in an ordinary, normal, democratic, European country. But when the opposition politicians here speak of turning Yugoslavia into what they call a normal, democratic European country, just what they mean is not always abundantly clear. Yugoslavia was once known as a global force in the fight for a non-aligned movement to combat global domination by the United States in the West and the Soviet Union in the East. Its longtime communist leader, Josip Broz Tito, was known as a bridge between the two poles and was famous for standing up to Soviet ruler Joseph Stalin. Even under the government of Slobodan Milosevic in the post-Cold War world, Yugoslavia has not gone the same route as many former Eastern Bloc countries, where they are now opening their markets to multinational corporations, privatizing state-owned industries, and deregulating their economies. But if the Democratic Opposition of Serbia takes power here after this weekend's elections, its leaders intend to put Yugoslavia on the fast track in the direction of its Eastern European neighbors. And as was the case with many countries, it will bring increased management from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Mlađan Dinkić heads up the pro-West economist group G17. He is widely viewed as a strong candidate for Minister of the Economy in the event of an opposition victory.
The new government will have a program of economic reform, and we are sure that this will be acceptable for IMF and the World Bank. We intend to present the letter of intent to IMF by December 15 and hope that we will be again the member of IMF. After that, we expect conversations about the new credits and, of course, solving the problem of old debt we had to IMF and the World Bank. But anyway, I think that if we have good people who are capable to implement economic program, IMF and World Bank cannot make any damage to this implementation. If the problem is in the countries where people are not so well educated and they cannot implement some programs, and the problem is if IMF and the World Bank make program for those countries. So we made the program ourselves. We have in our group in G17, we have a few people who are in fact employed in the World Bank and IMF and in some other financial institution in Europe.
Dinkic and other economists working with the opposition speak with an undeniable excitement when asked about the prospect of foreign loans coming to Yugoslavia. And even though the opposition is by no means guaranteed to take power after Sunday's elections, the monetary commitments are pouring in. The European Union has promised to release a substantial amount of aid for the country if the DOS emerges victorious. The Norwegian government last week said it would give Yugoslavia $15 million if Milosevic is ousted. The United States would also be expected to aid the new government. Another carrot dangled in front of the opposition is the EU foreign minister's announcement this week they would lift sanctions against the country in return for a change of leadership. But away from the excitement of the economists surrounding him, Vojislav Koshtunica speaks in more modest tones. The opposition presidential candidate says he is aware of the risks involved with dealing with international lending agencies.
When I'm speaking about that, I always have on mind the very difficult social situation in the country and the necessity to support and follow all these programs, including privatization and so on, with different sort of social programs. However, we are a poor country at this moment. We must take care of the socially most, the people that are in a socially most danger position, and care about the poverty, about old, young, ill, and so on and so on.
As tens of thousands of people from across Europe prepare to descend on Prague to protest the IMF and the World Bank, Yugoslavia could be beginning its journey toward the very system at the center of the protests. And though the eyes of Milosevic's opponents are focused in on ousting him, there are those who fear the fate of other Eastern Bloc countries, where workers earn Eastern European salaries and face Western European prices, where public health care and free education are quickly becoming things of the past, where the most vulnerable in these countries face increasingly bleak realities. Political scientist Novak Gajic.
And yes, I'm pretty much aware that it is going to have terrible consequences compared to not only to Central and Eastern Europe, but also compared to what was happening in other parts of the world, Latin America, Africa, Asia, in what we call the Third World. What is happening there over decades. Central and Eastern Europe are now becoming part of the Third World.
The Milosevic government says these elections are about a continuation of the policy of the last 10 years. In his campaign stops, the president plays heavily on the theme that the country is rebuilding and unifying with other countries in a struggle against Western imperialism. The opposition says it represents everything the current government does not. To win the elections this weekend, the candidates must win a simple majority of the votes cast. If not, there will be a second round runoff between the two leading candidates. So Sunday may just be the first battle in a war that will determine what direction the country will head in at the beginning of the 21st century. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade, Yugoslavia.
Demonstrators from around the globe are headed to the Czech capital of Prague to make their voices heard at the 55th annual summit of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. Groups such as the Initiative Against Economic Globalization, or INPEG, and Jubilee 2000 plan to mobilize as many as 20,000 activists to protest IMF and World Bank policies, which they say overburden impoverished nations with debt payments, harm the environment, increase poverty, and threaten democracy. From the Independent Media Center in Prague, Thatcher Collins has the story.
The majority of protesters are passing into the Czech Republic with no problem. But Czech media reports this week reveal up to 40 people have been denied entry at the border. Ava Gilmore is an anti-globalization activist from Italy.
We've organized a train from Italy, so there will be this train leaving on Saturday the 23rd with 1,000 people, and we've done this very big committee, which is composed of the association Ya Basta, of people from the social centers, which is occupied places. There's a big movement in Italy of occupied places. And then we've also got associations, like big regular associations, and two political parties, the Communist Party and the Green Party, are supporting the train as well.
Gilmore believes she is on a list of international activists compiled by foreign intelligence agencies. The Czech Ministry of Interior is working with the FBI and Scotland Yard, coordinating security for the summit. The result of that coordination is a blacklist of anti-globalization organizers that's being used by the Czech border police. Once again, Italian activist Ava Gilmore.
We have no expulsion process. We have no permanent process going on our names. So we can ask to be let in how many times we want. They're sending us back again. They are giving us an explanation. It is actually the German authorities getting out of the borderline, but actually the Czech authorities have just told us nothing.
In solidarity with those refused entry, a convoy of nearly 60 bicyclists en route to Prague remained outside the Czech border. They are demanding that authorities allow the blacklisted organizers across the frontier. Kay Morrison was among those prohibited from crossing into the Czech Republic. She explains what she believes resulted in her being a persona non grata.
I'm from Seattle. I was arrested during the WTO illegally, may I add. And I was planning on coming to the Czech Republic to be a street medic. I was at Badšanau. I know I'm not saying that right, but I was at Badšanau waiting for a train to the Czech Republic on Sunday. I was approached by four Czech police. They took my passport, ran me through their computer, told me that I was a persona non grata, and took me to a police station, searched everything that I had, ran me through the computer a couple times, and ended up telling me that I was not welcome in the Czech Republic. I decided to come join you and see if the force of mass groups of people could get me through the border. I tried again here, and they told me that I was a problem person and that I am not allowed into the Czech Republic. My guess is that they had my name from the WTO. I was also in Washington, D.C. for the IMF protests. I've been online organizing, and, they've got my numbers.
Prague authorities have been trying to derail the protests in other ways. They tried to intimidate the landlord of the warehouse MPEG activists will use as a conversion space. Authorities also detained and questioned legal observers after a meeting. An individual at a medical training was also briefly taken into custody. Prague officials have announced a ban on all demonstrations on the 26th, the major day of action. Representatives of MPEG are nonetheless encouraging groups of demonstrators to conduct autonomous, nonviolent resistance as planned. A unity march is scheduled to go from central Prague toward the IMF World Bank Convention Center with the intention of surrounding the building. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Thatcher Collins with Jade Paget-Seekins, Patrick Beckett, James Gloin, and Alex N. at the Independent Media Center in Prague.
More news from the Independent Media Center can be found at www.indymedia.org. Talks continue between the Los Angeles Metropolitan Transit Authority and the United Transportation Union, which represents its 4,400 bus and rail drivers. They've been on strike since last Saturday. The strike has forced nearly 500,000 people, most of them poor or working class, to find other ways to get around town. But the L.A. Bus Riders Union, which is comprised of 50,000 of those riders, blames the strike on the MTA, which they say is cutting costs on the back of its employees. Robin Yurovich reports from Los Angeles.
The Metropolitan Transit Authority says it faces a $438 million deficit over 10 years if it doesn't reduce expenses. At the same time, it has another problem that some transit agencies would envy: growing ridership. But MTA board chair and county supervisor Yvonne Burke says the agency can't expand service if it doesn't reduce labor costs.
It's simply that MTA costs too much. It costs $98 an hour to operate an MTA bus. And we can't balance our budget over the next 10 years, and we cannot expand service, we cannot keep fares low, unless we start paring down.
LA's mayor and its five county supervisors sit on the MTA board. Those elected officials have said repeatedly that bus drivers who they say earn a comfortable living have left their mostly low-income riders stranded. LA Mayor Richard Reardon.
A number of employees make over $80,000 a year, and this takes away from having an efficient workable transportation system. We want to get rid of the antiquated work rules that are like a cancer destroying our transportation system.
For their part, bus drivers say at a little over $20 an hour, it would be a rare driver that could earn enough overtime to take home $80,000. Most say they're barely making it as it is. On a picket line at the West Hollywood bus yard where she works, Arlene Mills says during her 6 years as a part-time MTA driver, she had no benefits. And her children's medical and dental bills put her $10,000 in debt. Mills says she struggled to get the full-time position she has now. And she says she's earned the little financial stability she has.
I've been with this company 8 years. I've only made 3 mortgage payments. I have just now been able to buy a home. I've made 1 car payment. I have just now been able to purchase a car. I commute 40 miles. Granted, I did choose to stay, but you do feel like this is a county and you will have some future. You are looking for job security and you try to be understanding as an employee.
Mills says the drivers already gave concessions in contract talks 3 years ago. A 2-tier pay scale that has newer drivers earning $3 an hour less than more senior operators. That, she says, is a continual source of savings for the MTA as senior drivers retire and more operators join the lower second tier.
And there's no way that I feel I am responsible for this company's bad management.
The city's bus riders union, which has long battled the transit agency over what it says is poor inner city bus service and wasteful rail projects, has come down on the side of the drivers. The bus strike is hurting riders, says Barbara Lott Holland, and she says her group is pressuring county supervisors to settle it.
Right now, there is no option for the transit-dependent person. They have to call around, ask friends, ask their county board of supervisors, call them up and ask them to support the drivers and end the strike.
Lott Holland points out that in Los Angeles, most people who ride the bus don't have other options. MTA figures show a majority of riders earn under $15,000 a year, and many are immigrants. Lenin Barahona, who works as a janitor at the University of Southern California, says he's been riding his bike to work. But he says a lot of people who are walking or depending on friends and neighbors for rides may end up losing their jobs. Barahona says, how is it possible that I can clean toilets and offices and the directors of the MTA can't sit down and negotiate in good faith? Because he says, we have to pay the consequences. The strike has all but paralyzed bus and rail travel in Los Angeles. California Governor Gray Davis has dispatched his cabinet member in charge of industrial relations to keep an eye on the talks. And the county's Federation of Labor has asked all member unions to honor drivers' picket lines. The transit agency planned to use charter buses for service on 5 heavily traveled routes, but couldn't because Teamsters Union drivers refused to cross picket lines. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Robin Urovich in Los Angeles.
In 1998, the Oglala Sioux tribe in South Dakota legalized hemp cultivation, claiming the sovereign right to grow it as a cash crop. Industrial-grade hemp won't get you high, but under federal law, cannabis is cannabis, and last month, the Drug Enforcement Administration confiscated a test plot being grown on the Pine Ridge Reservation as illegal contraband. As Charles Michael Ray reports from South Dakota, the Oglala Sioux are now contesting that action in the courts.
One early morning in late August, 25 federal agents descended on the dusty hills of the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Their mission, to confiscate an acre and a half of hemp plants that were growing in a small wooded valley on Wounded Knee Creek. That morning, federal agents got Lakota hemp farmer Alex Whiteplume out of bed with a phone call, warning him that his crop was being confiscated.
And as I got closer, I could see the helicopter just hovering above the hemp field. And here it wasn't no Indian cops at all, it was all white men. With black vests, and they all had arms. They had pistols and they had rifles. And to me, the show of force would just created fear in me of the white man again.
DEA agents seized the hemp fields in combat-style, drug-grade fashion because federal law draws no distinction between industrial hemp and marijuana. But no arrests have yet been made from the raid, and the tribe has filed an injunction to safeguard and recover the confiscated plants. The Pine Ridge Tribal Government says as a nation of people, they have the right to legalize, cultivate, and use hemp on tribal lands. Across the reservation from the seized hemp fields, a cement mixer churns a matrix of mud and hemp fibers. Pine Ridge is in the poorest county in the nation and has a severe housing shortage. Here, builders are using imported hemp products in a variety of applications in two housing projects. Advocates of industrial hemp say the long fibers of the plant can be used to manufacture everything from paper to sandals to roofing shingles. In 1998, the Oglala Sioux tribe legalized industrial hemp on the reservation in hopes of stimulating the economy by providing raw materials for local manufacture of hemp goods. The Oglala Sioux tribe's attorney, Tom Belenko, says the tribe has the same sovereign right as any other nation to grow hemp as an economic stimulator.
This issue brings to that distinction the whole other aspect of sovereignty and what can a nation do on its own land for its own development. Because this is really an empowerment. It empowers communities. You can grow 2 or 3 acres of hemp, provides enough raw materials to build a house. And that's in dire need down there on the reservation.
The federal government says the tribe doesn't have the right to legalize hemp. The chief of public affairs for the DEA, Michael Chapman.
No, it's not a sovereignty issue. You know, federal law supersedes, any other type of a law, tribal law out there. So people that are growing the cannabis plant are in violation of federal law.
Tribal representatives say the federal government shouldn't have any authority on tribal lands and that federal laws restricting their right to grow hemp limits their ability to participate in their own future. It will now be up to the federal courts to decide the boundaries of tribal sovereignty on this issue. Meanwhile, the DEA says it's researching any legitimate uses of industrial hemp. Exactly what uses the DEA are looking at is unclear. Regardless, those on Pine Ridge will keep growing hemp. At a recent rally in front of the federal building in Rapid City, citizens protested the hemp crop confiscation. Former vice president of the Oglala Sioux tribe, Milo Yellowhair, spoke to the crowd.
He may have taken out 1.5 acres of hemp that's going on a Pioneer Union Reservation, but he better have a lot more people, because we're going to be having 100 acres next year here.
How this case will play out could have major implications on the sovereign power of tribes to cultivate and grow industrial hemp. Advocates on Pine Ridge say other tribes across the country are considering legalizing hemp and are awaiting the outcome of this case. Those backing hemp hope that the case will set a precedent to classify industrial hemp as an agricultural product rather than an illegal drug. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Pine Ridge, South Dakota.
The Pacifica Foundation, parent corporation of the nation's oldest progressive public radio network, continues to be besieged by legal challenges from its own supporters. After a weekend meeting where board members were served papers for a lawsuit by listeners, the Pacifica Board of Directors was then sued by two of its own members, Rabbi Aaron Kriegel of Los Angeles and Rob Robinson of Washington, D.C. They charge that a small group of individuals on the board have concentrated power by suppressing dissent at meetings and depriving board members of information they need to carry out their responsibilities. Max Pringle has this report.
San Francisco attorney Kenneth Frucht filed a suit in Alameda County Superior Court. He says the Executive Committee of Pacifica's National Governing Board is consolidating power in fewer hands and becoming increasingly unaccountable.
One of the things that we claim in our lawsuit is that what the board's decision in essentially eliminating the right of the labs, local area boards to vote, essentially it vitiated, completely eliminated the notion of membership in Pacifica. So by the amendments that the board allegedly instituted, there's no longer a membership in Pacifica. There's no members according to the California Corporations Code. Now, the other thing is that as directors, they have a unique role. Mr. Robinson and Mr. Kriegel have a unique role to play because they are responsible to Pacifica and to the constituency of Pacifica. And what is happening is that the executive committee has not allowed them to perform their fiduciary functions.
During last year's crisis, Robinson, Kriegel, and others demanded to know how Pacifica was spending money. They were met, they say, with obstacle after obstacle and prevented from doing what they were elected to do. Rob Robinson.
We spent something between $50,000 and $80,000 on a public relations firm, the Feynman firm that did the work for the Oglala people, the juice people. And after Pacifica had been their client for a number of weeks, Feynman fired Pacifica. but we still paid them a boatload of money. So I'd like to know, as a director, what did we ask them to do? You know, what was the scope of work, and did they do it? And why did we pay them if they fired us? I mean, these are some key issues that, as board members, we have a right to understand, and yet we still can't see the documentation. And if that isn't preventing us from holding the organization accountable, I can't think of anything that you could describe that would be.
On Friday, Carol Spooner, founder of the Committee to Remove the Pacifica Board, filed suit with the blessing of State Attorney General Bill Lockyer against Pacifica Foundation, charging the executive committee of the board with violating its nonprofit charter through its recent actions. Last week, California Attorney General Bill Lockyer gave 5,000 Pacifica radio listeners from around the country the go-ahead to sue the foundation on behalf of the people of the state of California. The listeners, who seek to remove Pacifica's directors from office, filed their suit in Alameda County Superior Court the next day. The Pacifica Foundation refused to comment for this story, referring us instead to their attorney, Daniel Rappaport. Rappaport wouldn't be recorded for broadcast, but he did release a statement saying the Robinson-Kriegel lawsuit is nothing new. Rappaport said the issues they raise have been brought up in previous lawsuits. And he says their claim of being hindered from access to foundation records is false. He says all board members can examine the records whenever they please. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in San Francisco.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters from 14 states and on four continents are on strike against the Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. To learn more about the strike, check out our website at www.savepacifica.net. That's www.savepacifica.net. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Chrissy Clark is our distribution coordinator. Thanks to Leslie Holmes for technical assistance and to the National Radio Project for leasing us space. I'm Matt Martin. Please tune in again next week.